It was actually somewhat of a miracle that Wilson was able to maneuver so effectively during this time. To the Mujahideen, who flocked to his office whenever they came to Washington, Wilson was never anything but a buoyant presence, always leaving them with a sense that more help was on the way and that he personally guaranteed it. When General Ajaz Azim, the new Pakistani ambassador to Washington, came to call, Wilson assumed the role of his political counselor, furnishing him with explicit strategies for their common campaign to generate new funds for the Afghan struggle. The foreign minister, Yaqub Khan, was another regular who came to seek Wilson's help, and there were ongoing communications with Zia himself, as well as with the Israelis over the back channel and the tank upgrade proposals. That was all part of what held Wilson together that summer of 1983, his plan to force the CIA and the Reagan administration to radically escalate the war in Afghanistan. As he told Zia in April, the one obstacle that had to be overcome was Doc Long. He had to be converted, or at least neutralized. As chairman of the House Appropriations Subcommittees on Government Operations, Clarence D. Long resided over the 12 men who doled out the State Department's entire budget, as well as all foreign military and economic assistance. Few outside the U.S. government had ever heard of him, but Chairman Long was one of the barons of the feudal war that is the U.S. Congress, and he made sure that everyone who came before his Appropriations Subcommittee understood the power he held over them. He even had what he called his Golden Rule inscribed on a plaque and hung in the hearing room to make sure there was no confusion over who was in control. It read, "Them that has the gold makes the rules." As chairman, Long was so powerful that no Secretary of State or U.S. official, no matter how high the post, could afford to alienate him. He was called Doc Long because he had a doctoral degree in economics from Princeton and had once been a college professor. He was also, easily, one of the strangest and most cantankerous members of Congress, so crazy in appearance that Charlie Wilson describes him as being a dead ringer for the bug-eyed, crazed scientist and time traveler in the movie Back to the Future. As the chairman's longtime aide, Jeff Nelson, explained, "It was always an ordeal for anyone to approach the chairman for anything. Doc had this horrible habit of spitting in the halls. He'd spit as we were walking, often hitting the baseboards on the wall. I remember the Capitol Police looking the other way and just rolling their eyes." Nelson told of one meeting when Doc summoned the Secretary of Defense, Caspar Weinberger, and much of his high command to his office, where he slowly and sloppily munched on a tuna fish sandwich while they briefed him. It was an ugly way of making a point, but Doc liked to remind the higher-ups who wrote out their checks. He was strange in the extreme, but highly intelligent and dangerous to anyone who crossed him. Once staffers had to pry apart Doc and David Obey, the subcommittee's second-ranking member, who were literally attempting to strangle each other. On the face of it, Wilson had no real reason to think he could win over Doc Long. To begin with, Doc was an ardent supporter of Israel and an equally ardent foe of human rights violators. For that reason, he didn't like anything about Zia. Jeff Nelson remembers Long regularly referring to the Pakistan dictator as "that greaseball." He considered Zia's Islamic program to be a basic violation of human rights, and he was enraged at the idea of Zia building an Islamic bomb. He saw it as a threat to Israel, and on that subject he was uncompromising. Nelson recalled his astonishment at a hearing when Long warned, "We must be wary about the reproductive rate of Muslims. It's much faster than Jews." Wilson, however, was not one to be intimidated by Doc's theatrics. For one thing, he knew that the chairman liked him. They were both staunch supporters of Israel, as well as old-fashioned anti-communists. Beyond that, Charlie knew that Doc had a weakness that could be exploited. He happened to be extraordinarily responsive to flattery. Charlie had watched how easily the Israelis had seduced him, so effectively that Long's aide had concluded that the main reason Doc had become so passionate about Israel was simply because the Israelis were so wildly attentive to him. In the summer of 1983, Wilson first had to find a way to get his foot in the door with Doc Long. That's where Wilson's peculiar genius as a master of unconventional strategy kicked in. Doc had a problem. He liked junkets. More importantly, the chairman had developed a taste for grandiose junketing. In particular, he liked to travel to Europe, and he liked to go better than first class on specially detailed Air Force jets. Long's problem that summer was that he couldn't convince enough congressmen from his committee to go with him to justify the cost of the government plane. The members didn't say so openly, but Charlie knew the reason. No matter how grand the trip, they couldn't bear the thought of having to spend any time at all with this rather disgusting and hopelessly eccentric tyrant. In one of those negotiations that Wilson is a master at putting together, the congressman cut an explicit deal with his chairman. He would convince enough of his colleagues to go if Doc would include a trip to Pakistan to give General Zia and the Afghans a hearing. It was an offer Doc could not refuse, and Charlie negotiated it so skillfully that Long didn't feel in the least offended. He even listened to Charlie's argument that Zia was not only a nice man when you got to know him, but an invaluable ally, absolutely critical to the Mujahideen's war. After agreeing to put Pakistan on the itinerary, the chairman directed his staff to have the CIA send someone to brief him on Afghanistan and Zia's importance to the war effort. Wilson welcomed this initiative until he looked up to find his least favorite CIA man, Chuck Cogan, sweeping into the hearing room with his retinue. True to form, Cogan sat down in the witness seat in an imperial manner. It was to be a classified briefing, no press, no public. But to Wilson's growing alarm, the CIA's Near East Division chief proceeded to stonewall the chairman. He actually refused to tell him anything whatsoever about the Afghan operation or about Pakistan's role in supporting it, answering quite reasonable queries with, "I can't share that information." In fairness to Cogan, it can be said that he was playing the game according to the rules. In his mind, Doc Long was just another congressman sticking his nose where it didn't belong. Long wasn't on any of the committees cleared for CIA briefings. It didn't occur to this mandarin of the CIA that it would be prudent to at least accord the chairman the same respect that was second nature to secretaries of state and defense when they approached Doc's throne. Nor did it occur to Cogan to think that this peculiar old man, who did not control the CIA's budget, could hurt him or his agency. Long's reaction to Cogan startled even Wilson, who had witnessed a number of the chairman's more excited tirades before. The former economics professor began shrieking, "Poppycock! This is poppycock! I'm not going to sit here and have the Congress of the United States insulted by some two-bit little bureaucrat." Wilson says the chairman then began hurling chairs about the room, knocking inkwells off his desk, sputtering and ordering Cogan to leave, vowing that he would never be permitted back into his committee as long as Clarence D. Long was in Congress. Wilson was now convinced that all was lost. Long considered Cogan's performance to have been an attack on a co-equal branch of the U.S. government. It was an offense that had to be avenged, and according to Wilson, Long decided to retaliate against the CIA by cutting off all U.S. foreign aid to Pakistan. Wilson was so alarmed that he immediately forced his way through on the phone to alert the CIA's number two man, John McMahon. Wilson explained that it was highly likely that Long was about to strike out against the agency by making massive cuts in the administration's proposed $600 million foreign aid budget for Pakistan. Charlie did not have to explain to McMahon the consequences of suddenly cutting Pakistan's military and economic assistance. It would be a slap in the face to Zia, the man whose cooperation the CIA relied on to mount its Afghan operation. The $600 million in aid was part of a quid pro quo, and if it was lost, there was no question that the CIA would immediately suffer the consequences. The next day, a highly solicitous John McMahon appeared before Doc Long, utterly responsive to all the chairman's questions. He was there to repair the damage, to kowtow to the chairman. As Wilson saw it, the CIA deputy director's virtuoso performance was the only thing that kept Doc Long from sabotaging the entire Afghan program.